Not me.
Well, because blind people have to actually use the rest of their senses very well. It's, you know, I mean, maybe I'd have a stick to be my eyes, but in terms of interacting with people, I think if I would just interact with any human being, it really wouldn't matter, mm-hmm. you know, and without the.
So you're likening this to being blind?
Well, if all of it is something that's a construct, and so much is based on, I guess, maybe ideology or for whatever reasons or race or what have you, I think in a world where you can feel people and speak to people and touch people, but not necessarily, you know, have to look at someone and label them and, you know, put them in a container somewhere.
Yeah, I see your point, but what I was speaking of is not other people, yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Who would you be?
That's a really good question.
I mean,
someone
it's something
blind, but
I mean, it's an interesting.
Who would you be? I guess I'm answering the question with another question.
I don't know. I really don't know who I would be or how I would be had I not been given a religion, a nationality, or a race upon birth. I'm not sure. But it would only be useful if everybody was out religion, nationality, and race. You know, if the society where children were just born and were not told anything in terms of identification would we know what that would be like, I think, I'm supposing.
But
I can remember being young enough that I had no real concept of nationality or race.
I think I've met a lot of people as I've grown up who, for instance, are maybe world travelers and who really just enjoy interacting with people from other parts of the planet and really just appreciate the beauty and the variety in the human family.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of them. Where it's not about the label, and we're all spiritual people on one level or the other,
mm-hmm.
but it's about feeling the other person. It's about friendship. It's about bond. It's something very human that has nothing to do with nationality or any of the other stuff. And I think from friends that I've made, a lot of us sort of have that thing in common. You know, we may come from countries where other languages are spoken, but we both have that curiosity about an appreciation for the value of human life, for the value of friendship, for the value of bonding with people who you may not even be able to communicate verbally with, but you can both appreciate the same joke. You know, you're laughing at the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very beautiful thing.
Yeah, I've even had experiences like that when not speaking the other language, person's language, I found that it's not so difficult to communicate
No.
on a human-to-human level.
Absolutely.
And language is not required.
No.
Not really.
And you can share a joke and you both understand what the funny nature of
mm-hmm.
it is. Yeah.
I just think that that's really... I thought that that was like a fascinating concept because, you know, you could take it far beyond that in terms of how we identify with our careers and professions and we identify with our skill sets and or our identify with possessions. You know, there are so many things to identify with and to, in a way, have it stand in as a representative for who we are, somehow showing other people our value through our possession of things or possession of wealth or possession of some kind of position. And it's easy to fall into. It's very easy to fall into. I have had some real awakenings of how much I had fallen into, you know, job positions, and found a great sense of identification with it. And upon leaving that job, feeling a sense of loss of self. But it was really an illusion because I'm not a job, I'm a person.
That's right.
But it's easy to fall into the identification, identifying ourselves by something outside of ourselves. And so I think I do have a sense of who I might be if I hadn't been, you know, guided through parenting and society down the path of religion, nationality, and race. I mean, I think a lot of us know what kind of child we were. And it would be interesting to see what that looks like as an adult.
No, I remember distinctly. I was always curious about other cultures.
Yeah, so you're a lot. So you're very much in alignment with who you were as a child.
Definitely.
Yeah, I feel that too. I feel very much in alignment, but I've lost a lot of the bodaciousness I think I had as a child. I was a tomboy in the sense that I would go out into the wilderness. How much wilderness can there be in a city neighborhood? But but when I was growing up, there was a lot of brush, you know, trees. There was a lot of natural environment in the 50s, early 60s. Not everything had been turned to stone. And so I could remember wandering long distances for hours at a time and wasn't very old. I wasn't in school yet. And I was wandering and climbing trees and picking berries off of bushes and eating them and stuff. And I was like maybe 4. Maybe.
Goodness.
Between 4 and 6, definitely. So, because it was before I went to school. So I think that, and then after school, probably for a while there, I was pretty much one of the boys until puberty hit. And then everything changed.
Okay.
So, well, I kind of miss that self. So I'll put it out there as a question for those of you who are tuned in, might have a thought about who are you really? If you don't have a name or a religion or a nationality or a race, and you, let's say, don't have a profession either, but really without all of the outer social identification and structure, who would you be? Who are you? And it's an interesting question because to me, finding freedom is getting in touch with that part of ourselves and to find ways to channel that unbridled child into our daily life. To me, that's freedom. And so I'll put it out there as a question. 2-1. No, I'm calling the. I'm giving the pledge line. Oh, help me, help me, help me. Okay, the number is 718-780-8888. I take it back. The number is 718-780-8888. You know, it gets to be habitual, this fundraising jive.
Someone's calling.
Okay, so we do have a call. Let's see. Say hello. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oops, wait.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air now.
Who would I be if I didn't know that, you know, that question you said? I was thinking, Kathy, that, and your friend, fighting for a just society was a part of my, you know, when I was 7 years old, that's when I knew there was racism, and we had many other problems in society, and that was, it was a Jewish, awareness that you must fight for to make society better because of there was Jewish oppression and we fight for each other's oppressions. And you're saying if I didn't know that I had my parents pass that was the tradition that was passed on. So you're saying there was no context, but that was the context which gave me. So you want me to remove that?
Well, it's a question of, you know, the question really is one in which we can contemplate what the world would be like had we not been born into this structure of, as you say, injustice, right?
No, the funny thing you're saying, Kathy, well, I guess, yeah, I think I have some insight, which is that other people maybe who aren't taught by their parents because of their religion, whatever their religion is, or in other words, just look out for yourself, don't look out for the other guy. So I guess I was born into the socialist tradition, which is look out for the other guy, not the capitalist, screw the other guy. No, have compassion for the other guy, the other person.
But if you're compassionate, then you'll really have to be compassionate with the capitalist as well.
Okay, bad example. I'm trying to follow what you just did, but with the way you just twisted that. But let me see if I can. Having compassion versus not having compassion. Okay, so if I'm a boy of 7 years old who's being taught to be compassionate, as opposed to the other children who are not being taught compassion, my peers at 7 years, at 10, at 13, they were not compassionate. Okay, they were taught to look out for just themselves and their family. Okay.
I understand. See, that's the whole point of the exercise.
Right.
Is to discover what we would be as human beings if we were not conditioned. You know, because like the children who are growing up, as you say, looking at just caring about themselves.
Right.
Are conditioned into that behavior.
That's right.
And you, as you spoke,
were conditioned
into
the opposite.
Being
right.
The compassionate person.
Right.
So what I'm asking you to do is to go before the conditioning arrived in your life.
Okay.
And to sort of look within yourself to see who you are. It's very likely you would be compassionate anyway, but that's, you know, I'm not
right.
saying
the,
that
the,
you
the nurturing
wouldn't, or
principle.
Wouldn't be. I'm just saying that perhaps it is that you are, what would your life be like if you could reach back and see who you would be if you could have grown up in a natural state?
All right, Kathy, I'll give it more thought. Okay,
thank you. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, I'm on the air.
You are.
How are you doing? My name is Thomas. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you, Thomas.
I'm listening to your discussion, and I disagree totally with many things you're saying.
Okay.
You're saying that the genetic development that we've had for as long as man has been on the planet to go away. Why?
I'm not saying it could go away. What I'm asking is to imagine who you could be or would be had you not been born into this pre-existing structure.
Okay.
To imagine how your life might flower or what natural capacities you may have that might have been suppressed because of the structure that we're born in.
What talents might
you have had you not had your energies directed in a certain way? And so it's an exercise of the imagination. It's not an exercise of discounting the particular situation in the world. It's an exercise in imagination to move back in time to a time perhaps, or a moment perhaps, when we were more innocent. And before, in our approach to life, and as we grow older, we see the inequities and things change. But there is a point at which we could perhaps imagine what our life could be if we reached back into that sort of pristine self and brought forth some of that energy into our current existence.
I hear what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a father.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a child of a mother,
right.
And I'm a child of a father.
Okay.
My children, I try to get them to think in a manner that they can live in the world as it is, not as a fantasy. So you're saying that the genetic makeup, which I may be, to throw away.
I didn't say to throw away anything.
So if you're saying imagine, what value?
I'm not. The value of it is in moving to a space where we can exist in the world in our fullness.
Let me say this. We live in a world where the ethnicities that is developed by people develop power by economic, social, political structures. That is the world we live in. At some point in time, we have to think of, if we imagine, how could we have structures for people who are placed in deficient positions, from the African in Africa, from the African-American who is African in America, dealing with all these different tribes and ethnicities as they exist. I'm first and foremost a student of Chinwenzu, Dr. Amos Wilson. These books and their works deal with the world as it is. The problem many people have, they want to imagine a world that does not exist because they are placed in deficient positions. It is incorrect to even have this dialogue about a fantasy world when we live in a real world with power structures that exist to destroy us. We live in a time of genocide. In a time of genocide, the best thing we could do is imagine a world where these power structures don't exist. I don't get this conversation.
Well, okay, keep listening. Maybe you'll get it after a time, or you won't.
We don't have to agree. I'm not saying that, but it's a possibility you could be wrong. Is there a possibility, whatever has happened to you in your life and what you see,
it's entirely possible for me or you to be wrong.
Okay,
it's entirely possible for you or myself to be correct or right. And it's entirely possible that it's not, this conversation is coming from a different perspective. You're taking a very serious tone with it. And I'm taking a tone from the perspective of healing. I'm speaking from
I'm
the perspective
too. I
of a healer.
With you.
You're speaking from the perspective of, you know, the bold, bare reality that you experience. That's
yes.
Okay. I don't happen to be taking that perspective. That's
you
just the
children?
Way it is.
You have children.
I am not taking the same perspective as you. That's
you
all
have a
there
child.
Is.
You have children.
What difference does it make?
It matters in how you view the world. If you have a...
You know what? I think it's time for you to understand that you are speaking for yourself. And
no,
you have
I disagree
every
with you.
Right...
No, I disagree.
Well, I'm sorry. I have other
I'm allowed to disagree with you.
You are allowed to disagree with you, but I'm not going to continue to argue with you. Okay?
I'm not
sorry.
Arguing. I have
Bye.
A
Sorry. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes. You're on the air.
Okay. I just wanted to weigh in a little bit on the topic at hand right now.
All right.
One, I would like to say I do appreciate the kind of dialogue that you're bringing at this kind of hour. only because, you know, it kind of makes you think, you know, once the day and all its worries and whatnot are in the past, you get time to settle down and think. So I do appreciate this dialogue, number one. And I would like to say that if we were to start off with a blank slate once again in terms of no social standings, no social status, no social belongings, no social introduction to anything, I do believe at some point, although we're free and we're not able to grasp the concept of many things, there will still be some kind of conflict going on in the world, only because we do have leaders and followers. And by that, I mean, for example, if you have two children who don't really understand the concept of being mean and they don't understand the concept of being nice, one child just may feel nice, the other one just may feel angry. Them two have an internal conflict or external conflict with each other. And then from there, I feel as though there will always be conflict, only because we have leaders in this world and we have followers. People tend to side with a certain aspect, and if one person is more believable than another, then they tend to take that person's worries and strife on in life. So therefore, I do think if we were to even just come back or think of ourselves as like newborns again into this world with a fresh slate, we would experience life from a more of a personal aspect, in terms of we don't have the necessary the necessary stress that maybe like we do get from social standings and social situations. I know oftentimes with religion, people feel stressed with identity in terms of, you know, associating with being race and white, black, X, Y, Z. So even though we were to come off back as a blank slate, I think there would still somehow be conflict between one another.
I do understand what you're saying, but I'm not talking about moving into a blank slate. What the question I'm posing is that we go back into ourselves to the point of rediscovering our nature, whatever that might be. So yes, your nature may be that of a leader. Your nature may be that of an artist. Your nature may be that of a musician and music. You may want to build things. You may want to take apart things. What I'm really speaking to is not to pretend that we are a blank slate in our society as it currently exists. I'm speaking from the perspective of, on an individual level, as a being on this planet, we are born with certain gifts and certain talents and certain predispositions. And if you look at young children who are playing together, you'll see most often, well, there's going to be some kind of pecking order. It's not going to be based necessarily on a religious belief or a racial issue. It's going to be something else. And so what I was speaking to is that as we grow up and we encounter these different structures, we lose touch with the essence of who we were born as, the potential that came with us when we were born is often stymied or squashed in the course of these structures being laid on top of who we are. So I'm looking at it from the perspective of healing oneself and bringing oneself back to their fullness, despite the fact that we live in a world with challenges. So I'm not trying to say that challenges don't exist or that racism doesn't exist, but I do want to say that it matters if one is living their life in fear, if one is living their life with a sense of low self-esteem, if one is living their life with hopelessness. And so this is what happens, or living their life in perpetual conflict. Mm-hmm. And so there's a way to live in the world where one can express in their life a level of freedom. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, in order to get to that point, it's useful to go back into your core potential that you came in with before mm-hmm. it was tampered with. So mm-hmm. so that's really the point I was trying to make.
Okay. I have a question. Maybe you can answer it. So as the last portion of your statement, you said to go back into the core in which we were, in which we came into the world without any dispositions. So what are some ways you think that we can actually try and get back to the core so that we are able to live, I guess, a life of peace without the external factors that have influenced us by the time we get to the age 21, by that time we get to the age of 30 plus?
Yeah, well, the truth of it is that we are born with some kind of disposition. I'm not saying that we don't. Mm-hmm. We are born with a disposition. And, you know, a child can come into the world being shy. A child can come into the world being bodacious. Mm-hmm. What I'm suggesting is that we allow our memory to flow back into that earlier part of our lives to remember who we were. Mm-hmm. And it may be by remembering what kind of toys we had or liked to have. It could be by remembering what we really enjoyed doing. Maybe it was swimming. Maybe it was, playing with crayons. And okay. So what I'm saying is that when we can remember what it is, we can take ourselves emotionally into that feeling of what that was like. And that sense of being empowered and free and expressive, and then and begin to nurture that feeling into our current life. And as we nurture that feeling into our current life, we can look at what we're doing now and decide, is this really nourishing me in the same way? And if it's not, then we can question whether this is something we need to be doing, or if maybe we want to redirect our lives in another way. Maybe someone is working as a lawyer, but it's killing their soul because it's not something they really love. It's something that's going to make them money. Mm-hmm. So that person might want to figure out a path to restructure their life so that they can have that joy and passion in whatever it is they're doing.
Okay,
in the same way, we can trace back into where the anger began or where the low self-esteem began, because usually those things occur in childhood, but they're things that we encounter that shut us down. So I can remember when I was in the fourth grade, I was in a dance production. I was totally out there. I was totally happy, totally free. And I was out in this dance production. I was doing this little dance, hopping around with the other little fourth graders. But the thing is that when I was in the fourth grade, I was really fully developed, and I had like a C-cup breast on my bra. And so when I was jumping around with the other little skinny girls, my breasts were like going boingy, boingy, boing. And so the kids started laughing at me, and I was horrified, and I retreated. And so I, into myself, and after that, I didn't want to do anything ever. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to be in public. So I had to trace back into the root of the thing that wounded my sense of self and my sense of pride. To be able to get behind that into the joy that I felt, what encouraged me to do that, and just work through the other issues. I mean, it's like we were all fourth graders. It's not that big a deal.
Right.
But I had to trace back to figure out what it was that caused me to be introverted as an adult. So that's kind of what I'm speaking about, of going back into the fullness of who you are and mm-hmm. then get that feeling of fullness and carry it forward into our current life.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the person that had a traumatic situation? Maybe not traumatic. You know, as a child, you tend to over-exaggerate with certain aspects or things that may happen to you. Yeah. But what about the person that just decided to repress that memory of when something bad happened, so now they really can't remember because they shunned it from themselves for so long. So now they really can't get in touch with that memory and that aspect, but that is the very aspect that can possibly change everything. What would you suggest to someone who maybe have been repressing so many memories in so many situations? Let's say someone would have passed away and they just don't want to bring that up. What would you suggest to a person in that aspect so they can try to heal themselves?
I would suggest writing. To me, writing mm-hmm. is really the thing that could heal a lot, because you write through your feelings and how you're feeling, and it sort of allows it to come out of your system onto the page, and it can become less potent in your body. But also it's the same thing. As you're writing through the pain, you could also carry yourself back and allow memories of things that were good, and you can write about that. And then you can follow the memories of things that seem to be okay and trace back the things that were not okay, and somewhere in the middle you're going to find the energy of that issue. You don't actually have to remember, but if you can identify the feeling and work on releasing the feeling, it isn't absolutely necessary to remember it to heal it.
Yeah, I asked that question mainly because, like for me, I have pretty good memory in terms of things that may have happened recently. So you can say pretty good short-term memory, but things by a certain age, I really just can't remember. It's not that I'm even trying not to remember. It really just doesn't stick to me. Some people can tell you about a memory that happened when they were 4. I mean, I'm sure it's because maybe they've always told the same story and they understand that feeling. They've held on to it. But for the most part, a majority of my memories, I can't remember past, before a certain age.
Mm. And that is the value of using imagination. Mm-hmm. Therein is the value of using imagination. So if you don't have an actual memory, you imagine yourself as a 2-year-old. Mm-hmm. And then you just imagine what that might feel like, what you might be exposed to, what you might want to play with, what colors you might like. So imagination can be a very powerful tool if you don't have the actual memories.
Right, right, right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow, we lost a lot of calls, but that was a good call. Hello, you're on the air. Yes, you're on the air live. This is Heart of Mind. Okay. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Please turn off your radio.
Hello?
Yes, please turn off your radio. You'll be able to hear better.
Radio, okay.
Yes, turn off the radio. Hello? You're listening to Heart of Mind over WBAI. In New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis with Paulette Spencer. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Catherine.
Yes.
This is Professor Riven.
I'm sorry, I can barely hear you.
Hi, do you hear me now?
Yeah.
Hi, hi Catherine. This is Professor Riven, and I call myself a brother from another planet.
Uh-huh.
I'm kind of in tune with exactly what you're saying, because through my journey of spirituality, you know, I've finally arrived back at that point that you're talking about, where I realized that, you know, it's like we are one human race, and there's really no differences as far as all of these labels and stuff that we put on each other. they're really just artificial things that we decided to dream up. So it causes me to laugh a lot of times when I look at the situation as though I were not from this planet, and I was just looking from it like as if, you know, I was happened to be flying through space, and then I observed the planet. I say, wow, look at all these people. You know, they're one race, but they're treating each other like all this craziness. You know, they're smart. They seem smart enough to have it all under control, but yet they're going around like insane people. What is the problem? They're going like insane beings, and there must be some kind of a psychosis that, you know, that I can't fathom. You know, I can't figure out what's going on with that. You know, because they really seem intelligent. They seem as though if they wanted to spread all the stuff that they needed to sustain themselves, you know, equally, and all be happy with that, and even control their population so that no one would ever, you know, be too crowded and everything. They seem that they have the ability to do that, but they're just not doing it. It's like something's wrong. I don't get it. What's happening with these people?
Well, you know, it's one of the things to remember is that they are us and we are they. You know, it's not really just them, these people or those people, in a sense that we are all a part of this madness to some degree. And I just think that the human race has been subjected to a lot of control and programming for many, many generations. And hopefully we can work our way back to the truth of who we are as beings.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, that's what it seemed like you were talking about. Like, you know, going back to the essence of just when you were born, what you came with, rather than all of the indoctrinations and, you know, layering of all kinds of insane notions that... I mean, I understand the cultures and society and all the things that we talked about, you know, and hierarchy and some others, and leadership as compared to people that like to follow, and, you know, all of those things are definitely a part of it. You know, you can't just separate all that stuff out when reality is.
You're absolutely right. I think that there are natural leaders. But I would not characterize anybody we see in our political scene as a leader. See, that's the difference. These people are not leaders. A leader is someone who has the interests of the people at heart. And the politicians that we see, I don't consider them to be leaders. And I think, you know, so that's why I feel like there may be some real leaders among us, and I'm sure there are. But the ones we're seeing put on the screen are not true leaders. But if we can hearken back to our true selves, then those of us who really are leaders, who really have the motivation and the capacity to move people in a way that is constructive and positive and for the good, to me that's what a leader is.
I think that
those people who had those qualities have probably been suppressed culturally in society.
By the greedy people who want to be leaders.
Well, not just by the greedy people, but by the schools, by the religions,
right.
By the politics. You know.
So what do you attribute the original insanity from? Because we're talking about if we're talking about the natural state that when we come in, that we should understand that we're all just one, you know, entity, and that we should be just caring for each other as one entity, and then everything would be pretty much balanced. And so what do you attribute that unbalance to?
Well, I guess that would be a fairly big discussion, but a lot of it has to do with, well, then we will get into a political discussion. But a lot of it has to do with those structures, the religious structures, the governmental structures, the structures of colonialism, the structures of, you know, greed and power. You know, all of that stuff came into play and has been part of the human history for a very long time, at least since the Sumerians, I guess. Mm-hmm. It goes at least as far back as Sumeria. It probably goes further. It might even go further back than that.
Oh, Lumeria.
But
yeah.
I'm just saying that there are certain cultures in the world that have managed to somewhat stay free of all of this. You know, those cultures who have survived colonialism and I guess integrating into the modern way. So they're very far and few between at this point, you know, Aboriginal people left in the world who maintain their original cultures. And I'm not suggesting that that's the answer. I think the answer is somewhere in between of hearkening back on an individual to our pure gifts that we were born with and culturally hearkening back to the strength when the culture was a culture of strength and dignity and was able to hold its own in the world culturally and spiritually and politically. And so for me, a lot of it is about just knowing and understanding and education. Just my only for instance is even just as a black person, being a black woman being educated in America would lead me to believe that black history started with slavery. And that's a falsehood, right? So I just think it's important to go back to the point of, you know, the long, long millennia that black people have been on this earth. And so, to me, having that knowledge is significant in what I'm talking about. Going back into the fullness of who we are.
But don't those things, even these things, these notions of slavery and all, don't all those things seem? I don't know. They're laughable concepts. I mean.
Slavery is real.
Slavery. I have compassion, so I'm not really saying laughable, like, you know.
Yeah, no, I know. I understand what you're saying.
I'm sure you do. These concepts are just like, just so insane. They're so erratic, just, you know, to someone looking from not being on this planet.
It is insane. If you were visiting from another planet, they would say that you're
laughable. I remember President Obama. He was ribbing the Republican Party, and he was saying, you know, like these guys come walking into, they say there's no global warming. You know, even though 99% of the scientists say so. And they'll walk into the Senate room with a snowball and say, this is proof that there's no global warming, you know. And they actually come in there and they say that, you know. It's like,
okay, so I'm going to try to catch a couple more of these calls. Right. Thank you so much for calling in.
All right, thank you very much.
Bye. Sorry, the number is 718-780-8888. I was trying to get to your call. And I didn't get to it quite fast enough. If you want to call back, it's 718-780-8888. Very interesting. Okay, so I'm going to put, let's see. I've got two of you on hold. We'll bring one up at a time. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. How are you? I'm not sure of the topic, but I just want to address one thing. I just walked in from work. How are you, ladies? The reverend or the gentleman that was previously on, I just want to let him know slavery was real, and in some instances it's still real. But what I wanted to touch bases on is what's happening with this election. It's not a joke. It's sort of scary in a sense because it's just like I'm not sure if we're going to be able to vote for who we want, but I'm going to vote anyway, you know. But it's scary to the sense that Trump is winning and bragging about it, and he's like the biggest slave master that can ever be, and he's denying everything that he's saying, but yet and still is very negative. And riots, if he doesn't win, there's going to be a riot. Okay. Imagine President Obama before he won the election twice saying, well, if I don't win the nomination, there's going to be a riot. Okay, a black man saying this. You know, it's just the racism that's so blatant in this country should not be considered a joke because it's not and it's still real. But we have to just take hold to who we are. And I am a black woman, 63 years old, and loving every moment of being who I am. But I see this particular election as scary. And I'm going to vote because I have no other choice. Harriet Tubman will probably slip over in her grave if I don't. And all black folks should, but they should pay attention to the fact that we need to vote, but we need to pay attention to. To me, it's like going in backwards into nonsense that's now being thrown back into the history books, saying, okay, well, it's okay because I have all the white supremacists behind me, and I'm telling you that. You know, that's how I see Mr. Trump.
Okay, that isn't what we were talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I appreciate your call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, you still there? Hello? No, okay, we lost our other call as well. Don't know if we have much more time for calls. The number is 718-780-8888. I'm not particularly afraid of the elections. Hi, could you please hold on? Hold on, okay? Hi, please hold on. We'll get to you.
How are you?
Hello, yes, you're on the air.
I just wanted to thank you so much. Is this Heart of Mine?
It is Heart of Mine, Earth at Midnight, yes.
And I salute you. I just have to say I knew this was you, but you just had so many people on that were so diverse, and all on the same plane, and you came in with your own, and, you know, you tweaked it, whatever, but, I mean, it was just such a good program, and it was very enlightening to hear so many people thinking on the same level. As like you said, I mean, it's all different perspectives, and you judge where you are at. You know, we don't all start from the same spot, you know, so it's very hard to judge where everybody is at that, but you hit a lot of points, and I just wanted to say that was a good show tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And I don't know what your whole point of it was. I mean, collectively, what you really wanted to say, but you said it with, like, beating around the bush. I mean, I don't know what you really want to say because we're at a crucial point in mankind's evolution, I believe, that we must unite in all, you know, it's a new world order, as you can call it. Because, listen, and that's scary. Everybody's afraid of that. But corporations have taken over the world. We are now puppets of corporations that are bidding to race to the bottom. And this is a serious, you know, question that mankind has to answer. What are we going to be? Are we going to be animals that feed upon everybody's fears, you know, drudgery and misery and a big brother and everything else? Or are we going to be an open society where we unite as a one to be a species, which is common sense? It makes like a new world order where not a few people take all the money doing nothing but giving orders, and all the rest suffer with disease and all this chemicals and pollution and everything else, yada. It's insanity. And to see some people that understand that, I'm enheartened. I'm enamored by the camaraderie of it.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of us do understand that we have different ideas of what to do about it. But from my perspective, as much as racism is there and it's a real phenomena, and as much as greed and all that is there, it's a real phenomena. When I talk about hearkening back, it's important to remember that how race came about was to create a situation of divide and conquer. That's how racism, that's why it's being fueled. So that whites and blacks and browns and yellows are all going to be at each other's throats, and while we're busy killing each other, the guy at the top or the bottom, wherever you want to, however you want to call it, is siphoning off all the resources. And until we stop hating on each other, that's what helps to facilitate the takedown of humanity. So at some
you just proved my point that you know exactly what is going on.
Yeah.
Because that's been going on forever. And I was a little kid when we used to do that stuff. Make my brother fight the other brother, and while there two were fighting, I'd run off and steal his Easter candy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what they're doing to people. They're making us fight against each other, and as we're arguing and bickering, split right down the middle, they're pickpocketing us off the gazoo. Anyway, you got it. You go, girl, and I appreciate your show, and God bless, and I hope we get together on more issues like that.
Thank you for your input. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Have a good one. Peace out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe we can get in one more call very quickly. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Yes, you are on the air. Please turn off your radio.
Yes, I listen to your program.
Please turn off the radio now.
Yes, it is off.
Okay, thank you.
Now, it's a very interesting program with everyone trying to say what they were conditioned to say. And we first get to know who you are. We all came in this life blank slate. We're conditioned to accept what we're saying. If we go beyond that, we'll find out who we are and where we're from. We must first know that we are a spirit, and that spirit should control the body, and that body, which is desire, do go into having needs, having wants. How can we arrive at it when, first of all, we are conditioned in this world to accept total materiality and nothing spiritual? We lost our spiritual value. And by losing our spiritual value, we have lost ourselves.
Yes.
And we back and find that spiritual value that is within us and educate ourselves from the within. Everything that you need, you already possess that. It's here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for calling. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. So we'll talk to you again next week.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bless. Peace.
Peace out. So, Paulette, what are your thoughts? We don't really have time for more phone calls, but that was an interesting exchange.
Definitely. I think I remember hearing you talk about your experience of just sort of the sense of freedom and freedom mm-hmm. to wander and stuff. When I think of myself as a child, despite whatever things I went through, you know, in childhood or what have you,
mm-hmm.
I think deep down I was a very happy spirit.
Mm.
And so, you know, I think I tend to gravitate to other people who are kind of happy spirits. And you can, you know, each person has their narrative, you know, their challenges, things that they go through. They survive on different levels. But I can remember, you know, just this sort of sense of happiness, of, you know, fun discovering things. And I remember, you know, maybe being 6 or 7 or something like this, or maybe a little bit older, and finding kids that I was going to school with in the South Bronx whose families were from maybe Bangladesh or some, you know, countries where they wear sari.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as a little kid, I just loved the idea of being able to wear a sari. And I didn't have to be from the country. It was just the beauty of the fashion. And I remember just being a little bit obsessive with having my own sari and sort of parading around. We had mm-hmm. a fashion show, and it was just so cool to have my sari on. You know, I mean, little things like that, I think, was really a delicious kind of feeling for me to kind of appreciate how you can enjoy variety.
And how often are you enjoying that feeling nowadays?
I think I've experienced it a lot in my life, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now it's sort of a transition period for me.
Yeah.
But much of my life has actually been around similar populations where we were all working for the same mission, and the beauty of it was that mm-hmm. people I was working with come from every corner of the globe. So there's culture, there's language, but when you all understand what the mission is, you sort of lock into that, and you can appreciate that how much similarity there are.
Mm-hmm. And that can be a beautiful thing, and especially when it can be maintained in the forefront that everyone is working for the mission and they're not working in competition. When people start to sink into that competitive mode, the mission very often suffers.
Definitely.
Yeah. So we have to make some time for our upcoming program, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund, will be coming up in a few minutes. What time is it? But we have about 8 minutes. I'm going to try this phone call, but it has to be quick. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I just wanted to first of all say that the planet that you saw tonight in front of the moon was Jupiter.
Jupiter, thank you.
And the second thing, you know who this is. The second thing is that we're just past the point of the full moon. The full moon was 8 o'clock this morning.
Oh, wow.
You also wanted to acknowledge the fact that we had an eclipse this morning.
Wow, that's right.
A lunar eclipse, right?
That's okay. Right. The lunar eclipse was...
Ha, ha, ha. But I wanted to catch you, I wanted to answer your question. If I was in that state of pre-programming, I'd be synesthetic.
You would be what?
Synesthetic.
What does that mean?
You've had tapes about it. Synesthesia is the ability to taste sound and to feel color.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That would be, I mean, it was an exercise, and immediately I tapped into it. I felt that was as you, the word you used, predisposed.
Yeah.
That would be something, and I think, well, once again, thinking is not the right term, even though I'm a science guy.
Mm-hmm.
Kids already have those things, and for the rest of the week, people should really just spend a little time actually going back and trying to feel or remember those things, because we come in with it and we all see it in the little kids. They all have it. Just like Paulette was talking about dressing up, and, you know, certain people grab their hammer. You know, I was the person on the block that all the adults would bring their broken clocks to.
Wow.
And I would take them apart and put them back together. And when they come back to get them, they go, "What are those extra parts?" And I'd say, I'd say that you don't need them for it to work. So, you know, anyway, I just wanted to answer that. And as always, keep the good work up as well as keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course. Have a good night. Yes, good morning.
Thank you.
Bye-bye for now. And I guess we shall sign off. You're listening to, or have been listening to, Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine with...
Paulette Spencer.
Thank you, Paulette. And just as a reminder, for those of you who want to have a free massage or other activities, this Saturday, the 26th of March, 11 a.m. till 3 p.m., P.S. 073 in the Bronx, 1020 Anderson Avenue. The zip is 10452. And the phone number, 718-538-2000. That's 718-538-2000. And it's Assemblywoman Latoya Joyners invites you to her second annual Women's History Month Wellness Celebration. The meditation hour from 11 a.m. till 12 will be facilitated by myself, Catherine Davis. Paulette will also be there. Then there's yoga, Zumba, and massage therapy. That number again is 718-538-2000. And this is for all of the folks in the Bronx. But you could travel if you like. Thank you for joining us, and stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
Falling on the earth. Whatever we do. what to do with my strength anyway. Have we become a habit? Do we just start with the facts? Now there's no looking forward. Now there's no turning back when you say we belong to the light.
And good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With me via telephone this morning, Terrence Taylor. And we're going to discuss small screen. Very interesting series of reviews at the top from Daniel Persons. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The title of the new French animated film, April and the Extraordinary World, is something of a misnomer, suggesting a fantasy in which a young girl visits a realm of fairies, unicorns, elves, etc. There are fantastical creatures in the film, but none born of gossamer, and the actual French title, as translated by the subtitles, April and the Twisted World, is more fitting, since the film is set in an alternate history where the Napoleonic dynasty has endured decades into the 20th century, the world's great scientific minds, including Einstein, Edison, and Fermi, have mysteriously vanished, and technology has stagnated at the steam-powered level. Coal supplies have dwindled, charcoal stores aren't much better, France is at war with the U.S. over its resources, and the last remaining trees are sequestered in museums, turning Joni Mitchell from an ironic critic of the human condition to historic balladeer. That the film acknowledges the spoilage is interesting. Steampunk doesn't always consider the repercussions of carrying all that filigreed iron and smoke-belching boilers past their real-world expiration dates. But it's very much the heart of April and the Extraordinary World. The titular April, voiced in the French version by Marion Cotillard, is the full-grown daughter of two vanished scientists working on a formula to prolong life. She's got a couple of sidekicks and a sardonic, bioengineered talking cat and a petty thief maybe boyfriend voiced by Philippe Catherine and Marc-André Grandin, respectively, and is being chased by villains who have a Captain Nemo-esque ambiguity to their motivations, directly connected to the maladies of this brave new Iron Age world. Directors Christian Damar and Frank Akinci, in adapting the graphic novel by Jacques Tardy, have retained the artist's muted colors and dense detail, like a comics page come to life, and a very fitting visualization of a world slowly suffocating itself. Lots of rich invention here. The Eiffel Tower now has a twin, and both spires serve as a launching platform for mammoth cable cars. And there's a Wonders of Science exposition that features such amazements as bearded Siamese twin ladies and a mechanical dance floor where couples can pull aside their gas masks for a tender kiss. All in all, April and the Extraordinary World plays like Heavy Metal magazine made a stab at appealing to a family-friendly audience. There is a darkness to its adventures that makes it not the best fit for extremely young eyes. For everyone else, though, it's an engaging adventure. And I know it's late, but I finally got to see Deadpool and had a thought about it. Overall, it's a fun film, and the fact that the titular anti-hero, played by Ryan Reynolds, in the heat of battle frequently breaks the fourth wall to deconstruct superhero franchises as they are currently offered is a clever way of separating yourself from the pack. You know what would have been really radical? If Deadpool had also broken the fourth wall during those moments that are meant to build sympathy for the guy, if he had at those points turned to the camera and said, "See how easy it is to get you on my side?" Director Tim Miller doesn't do that, because as much as Deadpool pokes at the big studio superhero franchise, it is still a big studio superhero franchise, and that would just be a step too far. I don't really hold that against the film, because it is clever enough otherwise, but it does draw the distinction between something truly iconoclastic and something that just offers up the trappings. Being a big-budget studio film, Deadpool has no shortage of eye-popping special effects. The Turkish horror film, Baskin, has only one major effect, and his name is Mehmet Çerahoglu. Making his feature film debut, and perhaps his only film appearance, in this tale of a police squad who stumbles into the lair of a bloodthirsty cult, Mr. Çerahoglu, playing Baba, the cult's leader, grabs attention not just for his charismatic bearing, but for his physical presence, a strange wizened look that suggests a lifetime spent in seclusion contemplating unearthly depravities. Really, if the organizers of the Rondo Hatton Awards ever want to change their mascot, Çerahoglu would be a fitting candidate, with more chops as an actor to boot. Baskin, which means police raid in Turkish, by the way, is exactly the kind of film Jim Freund warned me against covering here, reveling as it does in torture and gore for their own sakes, and with a twist ending that's more, oh, come on, than aha. But there is an emotional underpinning to the policeman's interactions, particularly the relationship between an older officer and his protege, and a surreal intensity culminating in Baba's advent that makes this trip worthwhile for those who can handle it. Speaking of indelible monsters, the artist, Chet Czar, cavorts with monsters daily, turning out painting after painting of strange and frequently soulful creatures that navigate a path between the grotesqueries of H.R. Giger and the vivid palette of Frank Frazetta. The new documentary, I Like to Paint Monsters, the Chet Czar Story, which is now out on disc and VOD, delves into the artist's process, discovering that the fiends that find their way to canvas are actually part of Czar's paradoxically spiritual and decidedly non-traditional self-exploration. Director Mike Carell interviews friends and families and documents Czar as he prepares for the mounting of a major exhibition called Ego Death, discovering in the process a benign soul that has found its wellspring in an affinity for the macabre. One may have questions about an artist who at his peak was turning out 40 paintings a year. He since backed off. But as I Like to Paint Monsters documents, the inspiration does appear to come from a very real and surprisingly loving place. And if you're a hardcore retro horror fan circa 1970s, you might want to check out The American Horror Project Volume 1, a Blu-ray disc set of restored and rather esoteric entries from that rarefied time between the death of the big studios and the rise of corporate showbiz. I don't know that you could call any of these films here essential classics by any stretch of the imagination. The Witch Who Came from the Sea features a female serial killer and crosses softcore explicitness with weird psychodrama. The Premonition is about a mentally ill woman trying to wrest her daughter away from the girl's adoptive parents with some paranormal quote-unquote science shoehorned in. And Malatesta's Carnival of Blood is largely an exercise in Rococo weirdness for Rococo weirdness's sake. But as a time capsule of a period before all the glitches and kinks of independent filmmaking had been ironed out, all three films offer an intensity and unpredictability that make them worthwhile studies for the truly committed horror fan. As noted, this is the first volume of the American Horror Project. I do hope there are more. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time when we must make our stand. Speak out against hatred, speak out against fear, speak out against greed, speak out against Trump.
Couldn't agree more, Daniel. And one note, Daniel, of what you said about what I warned you against. It wasn't that I warned you against, you know, reviewing such things or mentioning them. I guess I wouldn't want a regular segment every week of films that offer gornography, as I call it, a term that I read in The Guardian once in an op-ed by a woman, and it's sort of like been forgotten. So, but I love the term. I continue to use it, gornography. I think the word says it all. Just that I deplore such cinema. I deplore the existence of such things. It's little better than snuff films. Anyway, Terrence, are you there?
Can you hear me?
I certainly can.
Then I am.
Okay, very good. You're on one of two pots. Say something else.
I will say something else.
Good. Okay. So then I've turned down, and now I know which potentiometer you are actually on. Good morning, Terrence Taylor.
Well, good morning. It is indeed. It is indeed. I actually got a large amount of what I was trying to get done, so I'm happy about that.
Video editing.
Yes. I'm working on the Invisible Universe cut, and I'm doing revisions on the material I sent her last week. So,
yes, and for those who don't know, Invisible Universe is a documentary that M. Osley Dukan has been working on for, what, 10 years?
At least eight. It may be rolling into 10 as we go along. But
yeah, first time I met her was there at WBAI at 120 Wall Street a long time ago when and it's a documentary basically about, I think it's expanded from being black science fiction writers to people of color writing science fiction.
Yeah, there's also speculative fiction, so it encompasses fantasy, sci-fi, and horror, which is nice. So.
The genres.
Yeah, all the basic genres.
So. Yeah, when I say science fiction, I mean all of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, Lord of the Rings is within the science fiction genre, so far as I am concerned. The rest is nitpicking.
And David Hartwell, now the late David Hartwell, once wrote an essay called Why Science Fiction is the Wrong and Only Name for It. And every so often I like to pick that up. Frequently I will back off to the term speculative fiction, which it can all end up being. And speculative fiction, for those people who think it's a new term, was coined in about 1947 by Robert Heinlein. So, just I was waiting your wow of amazement, but you knew that.
I'm so jaded these days. So little amazes.
Yeah,
I could actually say technically all fiction is speculative. So all forms of fiction are speculative fiction to a certain degree. We're speculating what people might do in certain circumstances, whether they involve science fiction or genre tropes. So, one could expand that to a great deal.
And
I could broaden your... I see you're broadening the definition, sir, and I raise you one.
Yes. And there is also the argument that was made by several people, much to the chagrin of Lester Del Rey, as I recall, that I think it was Sprague de Camp argued that science fiction is a subgenre of fantasy.
Okay.
It's fantastic fiction. It's fiction of the imagination. It's if it is truly science fiction, it's based on something that doesn't actually exist in the here and now. So it's a subgenre of the fantastic. It's literature of the imagination. There are so many terms for it, and you can keep on playing that game forever and ever and ever. Horror actually is one thing that I think is distinct, and I usually leave the explanation of that to Ellen Datlow. But science fiction and fantasy are basically genres, and horror is an emotion that you get from reading a particular story.
Add
to that supernatural horror, which is what you write.
Yeah, I mean, because I was going to say, not all horror is, Lovecraftian dread. I mean, some of it intellectually stimulates more than emotionally. One thing I like about horror is that it's broadened as much as science fiction, the definition of science fiction. So horror can encompass everything from, Shirley Jackson, being socially commentary in the lottery to, something incredibly dark that's just brutal physically and impossible to things that are completely fantastic and just kind of closer to fantasy. So, I think that horror is an emotional response to a particular form of literature, but I think it also, there is a lot of horror that isn't necessarily evoking that degree of horror.
Yeah.
It's the horror is more varied, to be more intellectual. I mean, I'm working on a story now where it's a very, the horror lies in its ambiguity about what is actually happening. And it's trying to actually write a classic horror story to that degree. I want to evoke in the reader a rising sense of dread, partly because that was what inspired the story, was just this experience with someone at the Y, who was trying to pull me into some crisis in their life that was just completely inappropriate for me to be involved in. I don't know the person nearly well enough to get involved to the degree she needed me involved, but obviously anyone in the room was going to get that call. And it was so disturbing, that what was happening with her, but also that she would be just trying to pull me into this. And it was one of those moments where you're looking at something someone is saying to you, and you're like, either this person is completely insane, and everything they're saying is a complete and utter delusion, and everyone around them has said that to them to the point that they don't say this to them anymore, they're now accosting strangers with their tale, or it's all actually happening, and the world is a much more horrible and darker place than I ever dreamed, and people really do suck. So, I mean, it's, you know, and in trying to navigate where on the scale of reality her story fell, I had to find a fictional outlet to get that out of my head. And that was it. I came up with the story that I'm working on. And but it's definitely trying to, I found myself experiencing emotions of extreme dread for like several days over the course of a week until I was going to see her in the next class and hear what other horrible things she had to say. But it was just, yeah, it made me interested again in the classic dynamic of the horror story, of going back to Edgar Allan Poe and going back to Lovecraft and going back to the stories that were deliberately meant to simply evoke in the reader a sense of unease that would not leave once the story was.
Yeah.
So we'll see how well I do it.
Well, indications have been from your first two novels that you do it well.
Yes. Well, the first novel really was that. I mean, the first novel was meant to be grand guignol, and it was meant absolutely to inspire dread in the reader.
And it had a certain amount of what I referred to earlier as gornography.
Well, that was largely due to the grand guignol roots. The second was less disturbing, both graphically in terms of blood, but also in terms of the emotions. It was more a lighter mood in that there was more positive sort of change happening with the characters, which is building up to the third novel where everything goes horribly, horribly dark again, and I'm working on that now.
Well, good.
Evidently, the darkness really, there are several people I've talked to who that was what they really found lacking in the second book and really enjoyed about the first one. So I have to say, one of the greatest compliments was from a friend of mine, the co-creator of Big Bang Theory, who read it. And he's one of the smartest people I know. Enormously funny, obviously, from his history and success in Hollywood. But he said that when he was reading it, he would just hit points where he just had to put it down and walk away for a day because it pulled him into such a dark and sinister place that he needed a break. He couldn't sustain it over a consistent period of time without breaks because it was just so disturbing. And that, I had to say, I told him was one of the greatest compliments I'd ever gotten.
It is, and it's what horror is supposed to do. If you feel horror, it's only natural to try to get away from it. What I don't get are the people who desire it in their lives as a regular thing. I'm not talking about fiction. I'm talking about the emotion.
The case of this woman that I'm discussing, I was telling a friend about the experience. I mean, it was something that started I shouldn't get into it, because if I tell the story, I won't write the story. So I won't get into it.
Okay, so
I had that happen once before. But what I will say is that at the root of what my friend was theorizing is, because she's dealt with these types of people much more, is that it's rooted in narcissism. And if you create, it's almost like a Munchausen syndrome thing, only with your own life as opposed to, well, no, Munchausen would be your own life. So what it is that you get, it's not Munchausen by proxy, it's direct Munchausen. It's someone creating such a wall of crisis in their life that they pull people into the resolution. I can't possibly do all this myself. You have to help me. Which automatically means other people are forced to pay attention to them, forced to follow their action.
I think there was a case of that in one of the listener phone calls that Pamela and Catherine got in the previous show. And it's something that a lot of late-night listener phone callers just need to do.
I think I caught part of that call, mail caller. I think I caught part of that when I was looking for the AI on the phone and an app I found that was listening to the show that was on before you.
Yes, and
It seemed to be spiraling into increasing chaos to what you were describing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lost interest. But I think it is a form of...
I was trying to be non-specific, but I guess I wasn't, because you're absolutely correct, yes.
Well, but I caught that immediately. I mean, I could tell immediately. And it was the experience I was having. There was somebody pulling me into their fiction of reality that cast them as the can't say hero, the protagonist of a horror story.
Yeah.
And the immediate desire in any rational person is actually of compassion is to help someone in that in a situation as described to get out of it. But of course, when you realize once you try, once you reach down into that pit and you take their hand, you realize that they don't want to be pulled out. They want to pull you in with them. And that's where the narcissism is. No, you must view the world as I do. You must do what I want you to do. We're going to create a mutual reality in which you have to do everything I tell you to. And that's why I spent 10 years in therapy, because I recognize these things, and I say no. And I went to her the next time I saw her. I said, this is, first of all, going to kill my going to the gym, because I go to Pilates for relaxation. I go to relieve stress after a long day at the computer. I don't need someone basically shoving their stress onto them. And it's like, I don't want to seem inhuman, but I don't know you well enough to do
that. Yeah.
And it was a relationship that had built up over time of like, you took my phone, my go, you know, things kept escalating. It was like, okay, this is now nuts. I'm not doing any of this. I'm not dealing with it. So my feeling was, okay, narcissistic personality, you have to just make clear, you have to diffuse it immediately. You have to say to them, no, I won't do that, but here's what you're going to do. So the next time I saw her, the first thing I did was I said something positive. No, actually what I did the first time was I said, I've had a horrible week. It's been terrible. And I just made my week sound as dreadful as possible so that she would be off foot and wouldn't be able to hit me with her grief, because I had to hit her with my grief first. And the first words out of her mouth once I finished dumping as whatever I could find to dump out in front of her is, a client of mine was shot to death by her husband this week. I just looked at her, and it was like, I wanted to say, well, you win. I apologize. I'm dealing with a master. I don't know why I was foolish enough to think I could win this moment. I it was amazing to me. And it was in the news. I mean, it was one of these, she's a social worker of some kind.
I'm sorry
she
for
deals
laughing.
With people
yeah.
with cake. No, but it was funny.
I had to
bite my tongue to not laugh, because it was like, seriously? I cannot fucking believe. I stopped it immediately. I cannot believe you trumped me.
I cannot believe
that I sat here and bemoaned my finances and my panic attack and all the anxiety, and you trumped it with one line. One line. I had to laugh. I was impressed.
I'm going to have to go back to the air check later and see if I hit the delay button correctly. I think I did.
I said it badly and I slurred it, possibly knowing. I'll be more careful.
In theory, I will point out, by the way, that in the news, the comedy routine for which WBAI is most famed, the 7 words that you are not allowed to say on television,
yeah,
by George Carlin, has just been added to the official recording list at the Library of Congress.
Well, I have to go online and see if I can download it.
If you go, I guess it would be there. Well, I'm not sure, because it's not public domain. It's just, you know, been... just like when a movie is accepted by the Library of Congress, that doesn't make the movie public domain. So I can certainly find you a copy. But that was, and that of course became the Supreme Court case that was the Justice Department versus WBAI-FM. People call it the Carlin decision, but the real name of it is Justice Department versus Pacifica/WBAI.
Much as some refer to the Biden rule, which is neither, and neither a rule nor particularly attributable to Biden.
The first test case of the Carlin decision was after BAI lost, was not horribly penalized that case, and the only reason we lost was because the broadcast time was Saturday at 2 p.m. And the court decided that this was a time when young innocent ears who would not understand a language disclaimer might be listening. And while the freedom of speech could not be abrogated, on the other hand, the radio station in question. And by the way, this is WBAI in New York City. Oh, that timed out so perfectly. The radio station in question had to be responsible. So it was determined that between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. is what in England they call the the water. What do you call an area that's protected? Watershed. Yes, a watershed broadcast time. And in the United States, it's referred to as safe harbor. So there was a radio show on Saturday mornings that started at 5 a.m. called Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah.
And it broadcast a reading by a fellow by the name of Harlan Ellison, who had just read for the first time ever the night before a story he'd written the day before called Shatterday.
Gone, yes.
And I put that, which was done on TV, starring Bruce Willis. And it was the first episode of the new Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
I think it was the teleplay was either written by Ellison or perhaps George R.R. Martin, who worked on that series. But at any rate, very, very carefully back-timed that story so that the story ran 45 minutes, started at about 5:30, but the last curse word was broadcast at 5:59 a.m. The story continued to 6:15, but it becomes, shall we say, more, well, family-friendly. And none of the, no indecent language. There was never a thing about seven words. That's Carlin's list. That's not the FCC rule. The FCC rule is about indecency. The FCC.
Well, I would argue that the F word is always indecent in its usage.
It's a question of context.
Exactly. If it's not referring to a sexual act, I think it's... I mean, if it's used as an exclamation, perhaps, I think it could be perfectly...
And it can refer to the sexual act as well, but, it's all the context. And,
but I think at that point it starts to edge into indecency.
Well, no, indecency usually refers to scatology.
Oh, well.
There's a difference between...
That's German sense.
Indecency... And versus obscenity. And
so I can get obscene, but I can't be indecent?
No, it's the other way around. You can be profane, but you cannot be obscene. But trust me, I had to legal niceties when I was chief announcer. Post the Carlin case, I was the chief announcer of this radio station, and I was the test case for the Carlin decision. Boy, did we study that. And, but it's all within that thing. Carlin talks about context. And the great quote from that, I don't know if I dare get away with it, because while the Supreme Court and the Justice Department and even the FCC recognize that 2 a.m. in New York City is perfectly okay, and even in California, where we can be heard via internet, it's 11, so we're within safe harbor, the Pacifica Foundation still has a proscription against such language, only because they're afraid of the court costs of a case, even if we're on the right side.
Indeed. And lawyers just live for litigation.
And they do. And they do. It's not even a question of the penalty. It's a question of they can't even afford to fight the case. So
they can't even afford to win the case.
Yeah. But anyhow, it's all about indecency and it's ill-defined.
That's life.
Okay, I will say it this way. To paraphrase George Carlin, you can bleep your finger, but you can't finger your bleep.
Yes, I remember it well.
Yes.
Actually, you could have said the first half of that perfectly well.
Yeah, but you see that one would actually...
But then you could imply the other, and that would be edgy and obscenity. Well,
Files, you see, that's the thing, is that you don't have to use a curse word in order to be indecent.
As any parent of a three-year-old knows.
And by the way, one of the shows that I hope to discuss briefly, in as we discuss SFTV shows, The Magicians, beautifully uses the F word all the time.
Well,
and
yes, they're,
harsher
they're
language.
Other people use the F word all the time.
But that's the.
I've only seen a few of those. I've actually decided I have the book is on my list of things to read. So I decided I'd rather read the book before I watch the series, or I can go back and watch the show.
Yeah, although
they only caught the first two. So
they are very different.
Well, yes, but nonetheless, the book will be the fuller, better version of the story, and the book and the series will be different. But the series might spoil things for reading the book.
Yes,
whereas
it would do that.
I will see the series as a variation on the novel,
but
and the book won't necessarily ruin the TV show, but the TV show could easily ruin the book.
That is true.
I
and the reason
to,
for that,
that's the when, order I read things.
Last week on Hour of the Wolf, our guest was Lev Grossman.
I remember. I didn't hear it.
Author of the book and a consultant to the TV series. And he explained very simply, and it was an interesting thing. He said something that he understood and learned about television and short form or serialized short form adaptation is in a book, you can take your time, and then, you know, 2/3 of the way, 3/4 of the way in the book, you can have an aha moment. But you can't do that on TV. You have to lay all of your cards up front. There will be no spoilers. There may be things that will happen in the progression of the TV show. So what happens is that in the book, there is a character who we are introduced to and forget about, who makes an appearance later on in the book. And then in book two, her story is told. Well, in the TV series, they tell her story concurrent to the other characters.
You realize you're explaining to some extent 20 years of his life writing scripts for television. I'm fully aware of these things.
I'm explaining it to the audience and hoping that you can elucidate.
I can indeed. I mean, one of the things I found most interesting in terms of moving from script writing into fiction writing was what to keep and what to abandon, you know. And one of the things you tend to do in script writing is you tend to outline them. You break it down by beats, and then you write out the script. You rewrite it. You clean it up. You give it to the production team. They give you what they need done to it. But you very rarely, and it's largely because of what you described, the limitations of time. If you've got a half an hour to tell a story or an hour to tell a story, and, you know, basically, it's the three-act structure in television, whether it's three 20-minute acts, now they break them down more, but or three, you know, six-minute acts and a half hour. Each of the acts, except for the last one, has to end with a cliffhanger to take you from the commercial into the next act to keep you watching. You know, there's all these little structural tropes that you have to follow, but it benefits you to lay it out, to know what's happening in each act, because then you can write the dialogue, you can write the action. You're following the story path that you need to follow for the limitations of the medium. And yes, I mean, my God, writing the first novel, I did a lot of bad short stories before I went back to the novel fully. And the joy of it is, A, you can just splash everywhere you want, and you can take as long as you want to do anything, but you can always edit it down later. I'm in the process now with the third novel of hitting an interesting point where I'm not sure...
And you need to tell listeners the names of the novels.
Ah, well, the novels were the first... The Vampire Testaments was envisioned as three novels that, in essence, were one large novel. I mean, ultimately, I would love to see them published as one giant 1,500-page book.
As Lord of the Rings was supposed to be. It was never intended
to be
a trilogy.
There we go. And the first took place in the 80s, late 80s, 86, 87. The second took place 20 years later in the early parts of the 21st century. The third takes place 20 years in the future in 2026. And the idea is to do a multi-generational arc over three novels. And the first one I wrote over 20 years, it was that trunk novel that I kept picking at for years, from my 20s and the 80s when I began it until the time I actually finished it. And the second book was written rapidly. It was written in a year, because it was contracted to be written. At the point that the first was sold, the second idea was bought. And I had to write that book in a year. And that made it very different from the first book. The first book was a lot of really sloppy writing. I mean, there are thousands of pages of that book from various drafts.